Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, I can take months to physically recover from a major medical event, but it can take just as long or even longer to recover from that event psychologically. And we'll be talking about that today with Shyla Mergane, senior psychologist, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation, the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She's a speaker, a writer, a facilitator, therapist, and in her clinical practice, she specializes in treating cardiovascular diseases and chronic pain and mood and anxiety disorders. She's also a sports psychologist to UW Badger student athletes. So we'll be talking with her about the mental toll of a major medical problem. And as you listen in and think about it, maybe you've had a major medical problem. What helped you recover mentally from that sort of event? So, questions, comments, I hope you'll join in. Well, lots of people probably out there have had a heart attack. What did you do to sort of come back to psychological health from something like that? Give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, and you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Shyla Mergane, welcome back. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show, Larry.
So what types of psychological problems happen when a person has a major medical event like a heart attack?
There are many kinds of common reactions. And when I think about this, I think about that famous quote. Somebody once said, if I knew I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. And for many people, when something like a stroke or heart attack, yeah, or maybe they have an injury that leads to chronic pain or a tumor that's cancerous or maybe type 2 diabetes, whatever the major, yeah, medical issue is, it can be quite shocking to people. I refer to it as often the dark night of the soul that people go through. It's a big wake-up call, especially if you weren't anticipating it. And depending on how the medical condition developed, the injury or maybe that heart attack that 911 needed to be called and you're rushed into the emergency department, there is that sense of psychological adjustment. And what I consider is going through various stages of grieving, grieving a 100% healthy life and creating a new normal. So there are four kinds of psychological responses that are quite common, okay, that we can talk about. We just don't want to stay stuck there.
Well, you know, I'm wondering about a sudden event like a heart attack versus maybe something that involves a slow decline or a lingering condition. Does the brain react differently to those kinds of events, something sudden versus something that sort of goes along for a long time?
Absolutely. So that first phase that people go through, especially when something is sudden, is that a sense of shock or denial. You wake up maybe after that heart attack, going through bypass surgery or a stent, and say, huh, there's a sense of disbelief. This can't be happening to me. Maybe it's just a bad dream. And then secondly, for both that sudden onset, that acute onset, and maybe something that's slowly progressing, there is often a phase of anxiety or fear or worry or helplessness, and people can become very somatically focused, noticing every ache and pain and catastrophizing, yeah, oh, that heartburn must mean I'm having another heart event. And then it can be common for people to go through a phase of anger or frustration or irritability, maybe lashing out at loved ones or lashing out at themselves. And lastly, there often is some sadness. There, yeah, can be some tears expressed. And if we're not managing that phase, it can lead people into clinical depression, which can really make that condition worse and lead to poor coping, causing what I call a vicious cycle of, you know, symptoms, you have this medical issue, you're not managing it well, you're not coping well, leading to lower mood.
And you're coming to terms with your own mortality.
That dark night of the soul, right? And finding that new dawn or that light at the end of the tunnel. And for many people, if they've been healthy or they feel like they're taking care of themselves, there's that sense of, oh my goodness, you know, I have an expiration date that I haven't necessarily considered. And people can really struggle.
Shyla Mergane, our guest today, clinical psychologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Love to hear from you with your comments or questions, experiences, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. And you know what? Julie in Madison has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Julie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. My son, who is 20, just this past weekend was part of a very traumatic event in which he was present when someone he didn't know committed suicide, and he and his friends were trying to render first aid, had to call EMS, the whole thing, and he's now really freaked out. And as a mom, looking at a kid who's about to go back to college, is there something that I need to be looking for or offering him?
Interesting question there. Sorry that happened to your son, Julie. Shyla Morgane, what do you think?
Yeah, Julie, I'm so sorry for your son and his friend who took his life or her life. That does sound quite traumatic, and sometimes being a witness to somebody going through an illness or injury or even death can be very traumatic, that bystander trauma. Or sometimes even the medical event can be traumatic. So the first thing to do after something happens is we just want to stabilize. It's too soon to go in there and really process it. So I would just encourage your son to engage in just daily self-care, getting ready for college, maybe getting his book bag ready, getting his school supplies, just anything to create regular routine. Sleep is really important. Exercise, regular movement can really boost those endorphins and help a person stay resilient in the face of stress. And then in a couple months, one of the protocols that I really think can be so helpful for this kind of event, when it's a one-time event related to something medically, is therapeutic journaling. And again, it can happen right away, but usually 3 or 4 months later, having the person write about the traumatic event for 20 minutes, 4 days in a row, and just writing stream of consciousness. I do this a lot with, for example, my athletes that are injured, and it's kind of traumatic. So you just write stream of consciousness, 20 minutes, 4 days in a row. You don't worry about punctuation or grammar. And what it finds is that it helps a person get that emotional reaction out of them onto the paper, and it helps to process it verbally through writing. Usually handwriting is the best. I have sometimes people shred it or even burn it because they don't want anyone to find it. And it really helps promote acceptance and moving forward.
So you say maybe 2 or 3 months, but how do you know when is there a proper time to do that, or is there?
Yeah, there's no definitive time, but it's usually when you're remembering it and you feel like you can face it, that it's no longer so distressing. But you do want to face it eventually. Otherwise, these traumatic experiences tend to be frozen in our memory. And I think about this kind of writing protocol, or sometimes even just talking to people about it, helps thought, so it gets more properly integrated in our memory. So we remember it, but there's not that affective distress about it.
Yeah. Julie, does that help out?
It does. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions, comments, or maybe your experiences, love, as Julie did here. Frank in Fort Atkinson will give you a chance. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I've been recently diagnosed with ALS. Got the actual diagnosis about three months ago or so. Had the symptoms for over 2 years, and they finally got a handle on what exactly it is. And, you know, when you end up with something like this, there's no manual. There's no conversation about your mental well-being. You know, it's incurable, and your body slowly breaks down. Sometimes it goes fast, sometimes it goes slow. So I am an internal optimist. I always try to find the bright side and reflect on that. But at times, you know, it almost seems like you got on a runaway train.
Yeah.
I go to support meetings, and they talk about what to expect down the road as far as transportation, adjustments to your home so you can move around and do what you need to do. But there's never a conversation about your mental well-being.
Hmm. That's interesting. And it's something that you would welcome, Frank.
Oh, certainly. It's hard to put yourself in that position when there's not variable in years because everything is going to be sliding downhill as time goes on.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for calling. Shiloh, comments for Frank here.
Frank, it sounds like you're doing a lot of really good stuff. You know, I love hearing that you're involved in the support meetings, and that optimism is just a great asset and will help you keep resilient during the course of how ALS progresses. And when you talked about, you know, it took 2 years for your symptoms to finally be properly diagnosed, I think a lot of people can relate to that. Often people have these symptoms and they bounce around from medical provider to medical provider, not really knowing what's wrong, but there is a sense of relief when they finally get properly diagnosed. And, you know, with something like this, I think, you know, when it sounds like you're headed in this direction is making meaning out of the condition, you know, of really reflecting on if I have only so many more years of really high functioning left, what do I want my life to be about? What are some of those core values that I want to express? What do I want to be remembered for at the end of my life? And I think about in the Tibetan culture, they do something called a death meditation, which sounds kind of morbid, but they, you know, each day it's more of an advanced technique, really think about the fact, hey, at some point, and you never know when I'm going to be gone. It could be even in the next hour while we're talking, Larry,
sure.
You know, and what kind of legacy do I want to lead? And when people think about that, what it ends up doing is when they face that endpoint, it really frees them up to live and they feel less afraid and they're taking that positive action, approaching those things that they really want to get out of life and letting the people know around them how much they mean to them. Or even something as simple as wishing the clerk at the grocery store a good day and bringing some sunshine and warmth to that person. And in the end, that's what we can feel good about.
And thinking about then, in Frank's case, for example, thinking about what he wants to do with the rest of his life and how he wants to proceed with it. That's what I'm hearing you say, too.
Absolutely, right. And Frank can even inspire others out there who are newly diagnosed, even being a mentor down the road, or even just family and friends being that inspiration of taking daily actions in the direction of his health. There's a lot of good that can come from this, despite all the challenges.
Yeah. Frank, thank you so much for calling and good luck. Appreciate your call very much. We'll give you a chance to join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Don in northern Wisconsin up next. Hi, Don.
Hi, guys. Nice to get a hold of you guys. I was telling your screener at 51 the week after I had done a mini triathlon, I had a heart attack while I was mowing my lawn.
Oh, boy.
And I teach a unit on health, and I refuse to believe I could be having a heart attack. I couldn't raise my arms up. It took me like an hour and a half. They flew me to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. They did quintuple bypass surgery. And I have never had depression issues or any mental health problems. But afterwards, once I survived, I was angry for a long time. That I had always taken pretty good care of myself, and I would see other people who apparently, at least in my view, have not been taking care of themselves, and it just angered me that it would be me, someone who always, you know, worked out a lot and took good care of themselves. I really struggled with anger more than anything else.
Yeah. Were you able to kind of work it out over time, or what happened?
When I went to see my cardiologist and stuff, they kept telling me that was normal. It just didn't feel normal to me. And then over, you know, I can't run anymore. I can't run more than 5K, which is fine. I'm 54 now. I was 51 when I had my heart attack. I don't have those feelings anymore, but it was the first time in my life, I think, I felt, you know, depressed. I couldn't drive. You know, it drove me crazy that I couldn't drive. I don't know. There's just a lot of things, just a lot of anger at the world, not at anyone in particular, just at the world for what had happened to me.
Yeah. Boy, thanks a lot for calling, Don. Shyla Morgane, I'm sure you have some comments.
Absolutely, Don. And I see people like you in my clinical practice, somebody who is really healthy and doing all the right stuff, educating others about health and school and running the mini triathlon, and then, boom, has a heart attack and needs a really intensive Quipple bypass surgery. And you mentioned depression, and about, on average, 50% of people after bypass surgery have clinical depression. So it's something to screen for and be aware of and get treatment for, whether it's counseling or some of the lifestyle changes like exercise or medication management. But anger is one of those signs of grief and something to work through in that sense of why me. You know, it can feel very personal, this medical issue that's happening to me. And things like heart disease happen for a variety of reasons, including genetic factors, you know, or stress. But it sounds like one of the things that you've been able to work through is instead of it being a vicious cycle where you're angry, you're kind of shutting down, you're not taking good care of yourself, you know, you're kind of upset about those losses of not being able to do a 5K or couldn't even drive for a while, and loss of independence. What I'm hearing you're doing is rounding the corner and what I consider is a term called creating a victorious cycle. Instead of why me, this concept of why not me, on, you know, most people do have a medical issue at some point in their life, and instead figuring out, okay, you know, maybe I can only do a 5K, but you know what, I'm going to really enjoy it. And starting to take daily actions again in the direction of your health and managing your stress and doing those things that are important. And then in a sense, becoming the hero or heroine of that medical story that, yeah, it did happen, but look what I've done with it. Look at the good that's come out of this.
Yeah. And Don may well be continuing to teach and probably could use something like that in his teaching.
Oof. Just think of the impact Don could have with his students. I mean, it'll be much more personalized, you know, when he comes from that place of his own experience with that heart event.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Don, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Shyla Morgane, our guest today, she's a clinical psychologist, specializes in health and sports psychology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She specializes in the treatment of cardiovascular disease and chronic pain and mood and anxiety disorders. Great to talk with her today. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like to email us, just email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Hopeful, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking about mental health, psychological healing after a major health event with our guest, Shyla Morgane, clinical psychologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today. Callers online, you can join in, 800-642-1234. And you know what? Let's take a call from Marcus. Marcus in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. So when I was younger, I started taking Taekwondo at about the age of 12, and I had a sensei that was straight from South Korea, and he used to have us before practice each time we'd meditate, and during the meditation, he told us to meditate on our own death, to think about being, you know, stabbed to death by spears, shot by arrows, crushed by an avalanche.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, the whole point was is to mentally condition us so that, like, our mind was in a different state, so that the small amount of pain that we went through during the practice was actually nothing compared to what we had just been, you know, like, visualizing in our own mind. Because essentially we're all, you know, dead men as it is, because given a long enough timeline, our survival rate all dropped to zero. And so really what it comes down to is, what do we do with the time in between? And, you know, you can either let something happen to you and it can define you, or something can happen to you and you can define how it, you know, pushed you on to further success.
Yeah, interesting. Shyla, a comment from you?
Marcus, how wonderful to have had that teacher at age 12, and it sounds like you've really infused your life with some of those lessons that he taught you at such a young age. Yeah, and you're really speaking about the power of the mind and what we attend to, you know, where our attention goes, our energy flows. And with health issues, a common pattern is something I call the broken alarm signal, that people after a significant medical issue can start to overly attend to somatic symptoms, maybe heartburn, burn or aches and pains and say, oh no, I have a tumor, I'm about to have a heart attack, and they do something called catastrophizing, where they misinterpret normal aches and pains in the body as being an indicator of something significantly wrong. And what you're pointing to is training our mind to, you know, not, this isn't the full-blown chest pain that is a sign of a heart issue, but just normal aches and pains that are part of the daily functioning. But in a sense, noticing that symptom, but then normalizing it. And in particular, what I always encourage people coping with medical issues to do is to develop coping thoughts. So instead of that mind catastrophizing or going into that negative automatic thinking about it, that doom and gloom rumination, instead focus on, okay, what can I do in this moment? And being more neutral or even more encouraging or even more self-compassionate, that's a place of power that helps stabilize your mood and really provides the fuel to do active coping in the direction of your health. Those daily things like drink enough water, exercise, get a good night's sleep, all those things that help you move in the direction of your health.
Thanks, Marcus, very much for calling. Does that strategy work for, you know, we really didn't talk about strategies for managing anger. Our earlier caller had a great call about being angry with his situation.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about some strategies for depression and anger. You know, especially if we look at gender differences, when stressors happen, like a medical event, men can tend to externalize anger and take it out on others. Women tend to internalize stress and maybe take the anger out on themselves and beat themselves up. So one, I think there are three strategies with anger. Let's say you're about to lash out at somebody. Having an adult timeout or give yourself a pause just to breathe. And if you do slower, lower breathing, that tends to be very helpful. Number two, venting. Give yourself 5 minutes to vent to somebody and just, you know, say what you're angry about and just kind of get it out in whatever words come out. And then three, just expression of anger physically. You could run or move quickly or walk quickly. I'm a big fan of a primal scream, parking the car. I had a husband and wife do this together. They parked the car, they got out over some cornfields and they just let it rip, or punch pillows if you're able to. So those three strategies, you want to get anger out of the body in a constructive way. And at its core, anger is just fuel. It's just energy. If we can mobilize it, it can really help us in taking those daily actions that help us live a really flourishing life.
Let's take another call. Bill in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. I just wanted to share, when I was 48, which was just a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And between that, and it came as a huge shock, and I wasn't expecting that. And between the time of the diagnosis and the surgery, which was months, I was dealing with so much anxiety and rumination, much like what you were just talking about. And I talked to my doctor about it, and I said, you know, I think I really need to try some anxiety meds. And lo and behold, that anxiety medication really helped me through that process. And then after the surgery, which was successful, I've stayed on that anxiety medication, and I probably should have been on it for years because my life is so much better now. And so I just wanted to share that with you.
Oh, thanks, Bill, for calling. So medication can play a role.
Absolutely. And Bill, I'm so glad that it was helpful and you're continuing to stay on medication for anxiety, because anxiety needs to be managed. And many people after a health event can develop something called health anxiety, where they're anxious about their medical issue or having another medical event. And if it's unmanaged, can actually create a lot of stress in the system and cortisol and heightened blood pressure and can make symptoms even worse. So managing it with can be medication, exercise. I'm a big fan of daily relaxation. We talked about the power of the pause, but a personal practice that I'm always prescribing everyone that I meet in my practice is slower, lower breathing or diaphragmatic breathing. Studies show that if you're breathing slower and lower, 120 minutes of diaphragmatic breathing a week, studies show that it can lower blood pressure naturally. So it's wonderful to lower symptoms of anxiety or irritability or anger, or even help us stay more stress resilient so our physiology stays better in balance.
And thanks, Bill, again for that contribution. I appreciate it very much. I want to give Kathy in Manitowoc a chance to join us. Kathy, hi.
Oh, good morning. I've been listening since the beginning.
And in the beginning, there was a comment about managing grief so that it does not descend into depression. And I'm just wondering, what does managing grief, what does that entail?
Oh, good question. Thanks for calling, Kathy. Shyla?
Yeah, Kathy, thanks for the clarification. I can imagine other callers have that question. So, you know, grief is when we experience an unexpected loss or a loss of something that's been important to us. And then when we think of health, it's often that sense of us being 100% healthy, or things like chronic pain may be associated with lifestyle changes, like no longer being able to do a hobby, or there's a loss of independence. So similar to a death, you know, death in the family of a loved one, we have similar kinds of symptoms related to grief. So when I say it needs to be managed, one is just acknowledging that there probably is some grieving related to the losses associated or the changes associated with the medical system, medical symptom. And yeah. Secondly, giving yourself that space to experience that sadness. You know, tears can be common. Giving yourself permission to, you know, take some of that time to reflect on what you will miss. Some people I know will even have a little ritual around some of those losses. And that, you know, it's so important that we're moving through the stages of grieving with some of that sadness, or as I talk, there can be some of that worry or anger, irritability, to get to that place of healthy acceptance. Because when we're in that place of acceptance, we say, okay, it is what it is, but you know what, I'm ready for whatever comes, and I'm looking forward, moving forward into my future. Versus when people stay stuck in grief, one of the indicators of that is they tend to look backwards. You know, they're looking back at, oh, it used to be, or if only I hadn't driven down that road that day, I wouldn't have had that car accident that led to that injury. So when there's that regret or upset about what happened, that's a sign I'm in grief. Versus if I'm saying it is what it is, there's acceptance, I don't have to like it, but I'm more forward looking. What can I do about this? What can I, you know, how can I make the best of it? How can I lead a meaningful life? Then we're in that place of acceptance. And again, that journaling practice that I talked about can be a way of helping people process that grief to move forward in a healthy way.
And let's kind of along those lines, I think Jim in Milton has something for us that may relate. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, you're welcome. I was just, when I was listening to your program, I was struck by the difference between some of your callers that they experienced a traumatic experience where they had lived a, you know, basically a normal life, and then had a traumatic experience, whether it was a diagnosis or a heart attack or something like that. Well, I have, I was born with congenital heart disease, and I've had three open heart surgeries, and I've had five pacemakers. And the way that I've always felt is that if you've had it from the start, of like when you're born with it, it's something that you deal with it more as a journey than as something that you've come to a full stop and then you have to start again. And just being positive of saying that even though the issues that you have are there, they're not a burden, they're almost a gift, because you learn to live your life around it, and you make adjustments, and you accept that there are some things you can do, and you accept that there are many things that you can't do, and many things that you can do. And I can't ever remember, with all my surgeries or anything, the issue that I ever was downtrodden or depressed, because I think it was something that I had from the start. It was like the color of your hair or the color of your eyes.
Yeah.
And so there's just, I think, a lot of difference between the traumatic experience of something that's unexpected and something that you were born with and that you learn to live with and adapt to. So, yeah.
Jim, I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Shyla Morgane, comment on Jim's
Absolutely, Jim. That positive attitude has been such a gift in your health journey, and I think it speaks to the power of our attitude. And what helps get people through? I worked with somebody a few years ago who kept a list of things that helped him get through, and he had quotes and kind words that somebody said to him and little encouraging statements, and he carried it around with him to remind himself of, you know, he had more support than he realized, whether it's friends or just authors who had written encouraging words, and that really helped him stay resilient. You know, and I think our attitude is everything, you know, and what we focus on grows, so we can get into that doom, gloom, catastrophizing, poor me. But the reality is life's tough, right? I mean, there's a lot of suffering, and there's nothing like suffering to be our biggest and best teacher. And I think as we start to feel like we're managing our condition well, and I love what Jim said, focusing on what we can do versus what we can't, because there are always things we can't do. But if we can focus on what we can do and feel good about how we're managing our medical condition, then often we can be a gift in somebody else's life, because certainly there are going to be people around us developing medical issues, and we can be maybe their biggest advocate and champion and cheerleader.
Jim, thanks very much. I really appreciate your call. I want to give Heather in Marshfield a chance to join us. Heather, hello to you.
Hi, good morning.
Morning. What's on your mind?
I am actually a healthcare practitioner. I work in occupational therapy, and obviously encounter many different people and disorders every single day. And I do have a lot of time people that will become depressed or upset at their situation, and other people take it very positively. And I do like your suggestions for what people can be doing while they're managing their conditions. But I'm just curious if you have any suggestions for all of us healthcare providers out there that may encounter this on a daily basis. Is there something more that we can use besides our therapeutic use of self and just listening? Is there something that we can work on with our patients to kind of help them kind of overcome some of these feelings that they're having?
All right. Great question, Heather. Thanks for calling. Shyla?
Yeah, thank you, Heather. And your patients are lucky to have you. I can sense your care and concern for the people that you work with. I think two things. First, validate their emotional experience and normalize the range of reactions they might have. And sometimes just by acknowledging it, it really gives patients that sense that what they're feeling or experiencing is okay, and it tends to lessen. If somebody acknowledges what you're going through, there's power to that, to its lessening its hold. And then second, I think the biggest thing healthcare providers can offer patients is hope. Hope that even though this is tough, you know, that you'll get through this. I believe in you. You can lose the weight. You can give up smoking. I believe in you. It may take some time, but we'll work together. And in that hope, collaborating, saying we'll work together on this, collaborating. I have your back. I believe you. I believe in you. And a way to offer hope is what I call third personing, or sharing stories of other patients who have done well despite all the odds. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a patient out there who was able to turn their life around, who was able to quit smoking, who was able to lose the weight, who was able to get the depression under control. And often when patients see examples of patients you've worked with that have done well, they believe it's possible, and they're more willing to adopt a mindset of active coping and doing those daily things to better manage their
and
health.
Heather probably has a whole host of those kinds of examples that she could bring to bear no matter what the situation. Heather, thank you so much. I appreciate your call very much. Kate emailed to say that she realized she felt guilty about her cancer diagnosis. Can you talk about the pressure our culture places on us to be healthy and the judgments our culture makes about illness and physical ailments? She believes those do place an extra burden on those dealing with the illness.
Mm-hmm. Kate, thanks for your vulnerability in sharing this. And this is actually something I was thinking about last night, that when we're diagnosed with a condition, our society can have a judgment. Oh, you're not taking care of yourself, or oh, you've you haven't been exercising, you're eating poorly, or you're not managing your stress. And when we kind of get into that, we shut down and we feel badly about ourselves. And the reality is medical conditions happen for a whole host of reasons, and we're never 100% at fault. You know, just our environmental factors like pollution, our genetic load, you know, all those things are contributing factors. So not taking that on, if we do, it can cause shame and shutdown and feeling bad. Instead, saying, gosh, there are other people who have similar diagnoses. Let me reach out and get support to normalize it and figure out, okay, I have this. You know, and with this, what can I do with it? You know, how can I move forward and engage in those daily lifestyle changes that can really help me flourish going forward?
And Aaron emailed to ask about resources for people with chronic pain after a traumatic injury. Are there some resources that you might be able to pass along?
Absolutely. Chronic pain, and I call it the silent epidemic. The more people have chronic pain than diabetes, heart disease, and cancer combined. There's some great books out there. One of my personal favorites is Managing Pain Before It Manages You. And some of our healthcare systems have chronic pain groups, including UW, that I co-facilitate. And I think with pain, there's 50% medical management that your medical team is providing, but then also 50% self-management, using those self-management tools and doing a group or getting individual counseling with a pain psychologist, or even reading a resource like I mentioned, will give you that toolbox to help you really cope with a complex problem like chronic pain that you may feel unprepared to deal with.
And once more, the title of the book that you like?
Yeah, Managing Pain Before It Manages You.
Managing Pain Before It Manages You.
Yeah, and our public library has several copies out there that previous patients of mine have donated. Yeah.
Many times patients will have to live with that chronic pain. Can music play a part in dealing with pain?
You know, Larry, that is so fun that you ask, because absolutely, and it's not something that we think about in our toolbox, but there was a study that looked at music and its impact on acute pain and chronic pain. And indeed, it found all forms of music had some pain reduction benefit. And I think for two reasons. One, music's a great distraction, right? You know, you're listening to it. It can, you know, boost your mood. And then two, I think, which I'm saying, it just kind of can produce that more positive outlook, and it can produce some of those positive emotions that are natural pain reducers. So absolutely, you know, if you're noticing pain, put on some music, and, you know, whether it's classical music or jazz or even heavy metal or rap, you know, put it out there, and, you know, you might just be surprised to notice less sensations of pain in the body.
One of the reasons I asked that is because coming up next, we're going to be talking about mood-changing music, and we'll be hearing some songs that I think put me in a good mood. I hope they put everybody else in a good mood as well. And I'm always in a good mood when you stop by, Shyla. Thank you so much for being with us today. And you're back on November 20th.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll do this all over again.
Yes, I can't wait. Thanks so much, Larry. Have a great rest of your summer.
You as well. Shyla Mergain, clinical psychologist. She is a speaker, writer, facilitator, therapist, and she specializes in the treatment of cardiovascular disease and chronic pain and mood and anxiety disorders. So she'll be back on November 20th. We'll do this all over again. But coming up, we're going to hear some music and talk about music that affects your mood, hopefully in a positive way. That next on the Ideas Network.